This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we learn about a lawsuit alleging that it was elements of the Saudi Arabian government that attacked the United States on September 11th.
If it was the elements of the Saudi Arabian government, which is becoming increasingly clear, then it wasn't Iraq, and therefore the attack on Iraq was a criminal act, a war of aggression.
In a stunning victory for West Virginia teachers, the governor and state legislator have granted a 5% wage increase.
Not just to the teachers, but to all West Virginia state employees. The struggle was extraordinary and militant and led by women. Is this a sign of what's to come in the future?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
After 9 days of the West Virginia teachers' strike, the West Virginia governor and the state legislature caved in, granting the teachers and all school staff a 5% wage increase. The pay raise also covers all state employees. In an attempt to save face, the Republicans talked about funding the pay increase by cutting social services and Medicaid. But there's no such wording in the agreement that was signed by the West Virginia Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, the two workers' organizations. One strike supporter in West Virginia stated, "At this point, the teachers and school staff have all the momentum, and they can fight to make sure the funds for the raise come from the rich, not working people, when the budget is eventually passed." Strikers here are ecstatic. People are literally hugging strangers and weeping in joy. It's been a stark victory for the working class. Hopefully, it'll be the first of many to come. The strike was caused by decades of stagnating pay and rising health costs. 3/4 of the teachers in West Virginia are women. Women played a leading role in the strike. West Virginia, especially its southern counties, have a long history of militancy, especially in the coal mines. Teacher job actions and walkouts spread from these very same southern counties. The West Virginia teachers have shown Americans what it takes to win a strike. This is especially important when the anticipated Supreme Court ruling in the Janus case comes down. That ruling will likely reduce the power of public employee unions by taking away their right to collect dues. We speak today with Dale Lee, the head of the West Virginia Education Association.
Dale Lee, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What were the conditions that caused the teachers to go out on strike, and what were the goals of the strike?
You know, we've had years of broken promises, of saying that every politician saying that they wanted to make education the centerpiece of our economic development, and yet finding ways not to fund it. We were 48th in the nation in pay. Our health care the last few years have been balanced on the backs of the employees, the backs of the teachers, service professionals, state workers. Then we started seeing more and more anti-education bills being introduced and moving in the legislature. Finally, the teachers said, and service professionals said, we've had enough. You know, we can't continue to pay lip service. The proposal last year when we had a $500 million deficit in the state was to give teachers a 2% pay raise. This year, it looked like we had a $32 million surplus, and yet the proposal for a teacher pay raise was 1%. And when that started, that angered everybody. And then when the new health insurance plan started to kick in, and we had a program called Go 365, which meant you had to do some exercising and things that you could develop to earn gift cards at Amazon. But if you didn't do it, your premiums were going to increase. And then the health care plan looked at total family income instead of your individual income, and it just set people off. They decided they'd had enough, and their voices were going to be heard.
And what was the position of the government in terms of not increasing wages?
Well, again, there was a small increase proposed, and that we really were looking at a 1% increase for each of the next 5 years. But that wouldn't do anything to move us in the rankings. It wouldn't do anything to attract people into the profession. The second month report this year, we had 727 positions across the state that didn't have a certified teacher in them. Our contiguous states, you can make anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000 more by many of our counties driving 15 to 30 minutes. So we're having trouble keeping the young teachers in the state, and this didn't address it. So it got to the point where we said we have to make sure that we're addressing this. And then finally our governor said, after some prodding, that it's time to make an investment in education. We have to stop funding education and make the investment in education.
I'm curious, what is the starting salary for a teacher?
Starting salary in West Virginia is about $33,000. Yeah. And in 2014, the last pay raise we had, it was a $1,000 pay raise, and they actually put in the statute, in the language, that our goal was to get beginning teacher salaries to $43,000 by 2019, which would have required about a $2,000 a year raise at that point. Then we went 3 years with no raises at all.
Dale Lee, what was the significance of the union advocating what they called five for all, you know, 5% increase for the union and others? And how did that help in terms of not allowing the government to use divide and conquer tactics?
Right. We saw tremendous, tremendous community support. All of our public employees were supporting us. While we were the ones that were out on strike and our public employees couldn't do that, they were doing so many things to help the support. And our parents were tremendously supportive. Communities were supportive. Our superintendents were supportive. And we knew that there was going to be a attempt to try to divide and conquer. Then when the Senate went from the 5% to 4%, saying that everybody should get the same thing, it just infuriated our people even more. You don't bring one group down to bring another group up. You bring everyone up. And that was the rallying cry with it had to be 5% for all.
Dale, how did the strikes evolve from job actions and walkouts?
Well, we first started, really it seemed like years ago, but probably about 4 weeks ago, four of our southern counties, who are coalfield counties, decided they'd had enough and they were doing a one-day walkout. It was Wyoming County, Mingo County, McDowell County, and Logan County. And that's where the tradition of the United Mine Workers started. I grew up in Wyoming County. It's our heritage that when you're wrong to a point, that's the course of action you take. You stand up. You collectively stand up and say enough's enough. So we had the one-day walkout there. Following week, we had the vote on all of our 55 counties, given the association and the other group the authority to call a statewide action. Then the following Friday, six more counties did a one-day walkout. That's when we announced the next day on Saturday at a rally that if no action was taken by the legislature, we would take our 55 United County work action on that Thursday and Friday, and then it extended over the next week, even when we thought we had the deal cut, and finished up then on Tuesday. One of the reasons that people weren't going back, is because of so much distrust. I mean, we've been promised things before, and it proved to be prophetic because the Senate then wanted to play games with the Rays.
Dale, we're interviewing you on International Women's Day. Can you speak about the role of women in the strike?
Oh, my gosh. Our profession is nationally 70% women anyway. And our women stood extremely strong. They wanted to make their voice heard. They were here every day saying that not only are we demanding our voice heard now, but our voices will be heard again in November because the women will vote. I'm so proud of all of our teachers and service professionals. And one of the things that makes me most proud is immediately on the Saturday we called the work action, our people started going back to their counties and working with churches and communities and started setting up food banks and providing hot meals for our students, because so many of our kids are in poverty in West Virginia. They wanted to make sure they didn't miss meals, that they got hot meals. They worked with churches on the backpacks full of food for the weekends and to make sure that the families had food while we were out. They provided daycare for kids and different things like that. So our teachers and service professionals started immediately doing what we do every day, and that's taking care of our kids.
What kind of solidarity did you receive? We heard that you got 700 pizzas from San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people from all over the nation were sending support, letters of support. We had the pizzas from San Francisco. We have other associations, members of the NEA associations sending money in for us to buy pizzas, to buy water, things like that. The support was just tremendous. We got the eyes of the nation on us, and that in a positive way in West Virginia, and we're proud of that too.
Dale Lee, you're the head of an educational organization in West Virginia. You must be very concerned about it. The Supreme Court heard arguments in the Janus case, and we're awaiting a ruling which most union people think will go against us. What's the meaning of the Janus case, and what lessons can we learn from the West Virginia teachers on how to combat the strategy to weaken unions?
Actually, it's odd that that's happening, because we are a non-bargaining state. We're a right-to-work state, and our teachers have always been non-bargaining. So without collective bargaining here in West Virginia, we've been able, because of the strength of the association, we've been able to get some things into statute that other states have to bargain for, like duty-free lunch, planning period during the instructional day, different things like that. But what we showed in West Virginia is, even without collective bargaining, if you're standing together in unity and you're shouting with one voice and demanding that your voices be heard, that the union, the association, is strongest when everyone's united.
Can you talk about the role that the Democratic Party played in the strike?
Sure. In the Senate, the Democratic Party stood strong and tried three different times to dismiss the pay bill, which had been sent to Senate Finance, and we had the 12 Democratic senators plus two Republican senators who were voting each time to dismiss it, and then decided they didn't want it to go. In the House, our Democratic caucus stood strong with us. We weren't going to budge from 5%. Then when the deal was made with the governor to do the 5% and to take care of our health care and get the anti-education bills off the table, and the union busting bill with the paycheck deception bill, that was taken off the agendas. When they did that, our Democrats stood strong, and really our entire House stood strong. The House passed the bill in one day, suspended the rules, passed the bill in one day, and stayed committed that it had to be 5%. Our Democratic senators stood strong and demanded that we were going to stay at 5%, and that strength helped us break the both the Democrats in the House and the Senate. That strength helped us to break the deadlock in the Senate and get the deal actually cut.
The Oklahoma teachers are in the same position that the West Virginia teachers were in before the strike. One of the things that the demonstrators were chanting was West Virginia first, Oklahoma next. Do you think that we're on the verge of a new militant situation in the American labor movement?
I think what we've proven in West Virginia is that labor has to have their voice heard. We're going to demand to have our voices heard. What I hope will happen is that governors and legislators in these other states will see what happened in West Virginia and decide it's now time to make an investment in education, an investment in our people, investment in our working people, instead of trying to more and more to take away from them.
That's an inspiring thought to end the interview with you, Dale. We're certainly grateful to be able to talk to you. Congratulations again, a hearty congratulations for your magnificent victory. And we look forward to seeing more good stuff coming out of other states like came out of West Virginia.
Thank you. And let me make a closing comment. The real winners in this are the children of West Virginia. Our educators, our teachers and service professionals stood strong and stood their ground. And the real winners coming out of this is the children of West Virginia, because by making an investment in education, we're going to provide for them in the long term.
So well said, Dale. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You take it easy.
Bye-bye. Right.
Nearly 16 years have passed since the 9/11 attacks. The truth of who was behind the attacks has allegedly come out in a lawsuit brought by over 6,500 victims and survivors. The lawsuit alleges that it was elements of the Saudi Arabian government that attacked the United States on 9/11. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabian citizens. The defendant in the lawsuits is Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabian government hired 15 public relations firms to help them deny responsibility. They hired several Washington White Shoe high-powered connected law firms as well. They hid behind the law of sovereign immunity, which had to be overturned by an act of Congress in order for the lawsuit to proceed. They were helped by the U.S. government in the cover-up by the Bush and the Obama administrations. After 16 and a half years, the case is now proceeding rapidly through the federal courts and will either be dismissed, settled, or tried. The object of the lawsuit is to obtain money, explained Sharon Pemboli, one of the plaintiffs and leaders of a group of women from New Jersey known as the Jersey Girls, who lobbied to win passage of the law which made the lawsuit possible. She believes that if the Saudi Arabian government is deprived of funds, it will not be able to fund al-Qaeda and the extremist Wahhabi clergy responsible for supporting the terrorism of al-Qaeda. The American public has been led to believe mistakenly that Saddam Hussein and Iraq were behind the 9/11 attacks. The American response in attacking Iraq was a war of aggression. At the end of World War II, the United States set up the Nuremberg trials to try Nazi war criminals. They wanted to set forth principles that were not merely victor's justice. At the Nuremberg trials, the Germans were found guilty of starting a war of aggression, which was called the greatest of all crimes because it has contained within it all other crimes. Here to speak with us today about the lawsuit against the Saudi Arabian government is attorney Justin Green, who works at the firm Kreindler & Kreindler, a leading aviation and plaintiffs law firm in America.
Attorney Justin Green, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
How did you and your law firm get involved in this class action lawsuit?
Well, it goes back to really the 9/11. We're a New York law firm, and obviously, with a history of doing aviation cases and also terrorism cases, we're perhaps best known for the Pan Am Lockerbie litigation, which ended up in a terrorism lawsuit against Libya and a historic recovery. So very soon after 9/11, we started getting calls from family members who wanted to seek justice.
And what is the status of the lawsuit now?
Right now, the status of the lawsuit is that we're in discovery against a number of defendants, but the main focus of the case right now is against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And your listeners may know that about 2 years ago, Congress considered and ultimately passed over President Obama's veto a law called the Justice Against State Sponsors of Terrorism Act, commonly referred to as JASTA, that permitted the 9/11 victims to sue any nation who sponsors an attack in the United States, which really was directed against the plaintiff's allegations against Saudi Arabia. So lawsuits probably starting about a year ago have been filed by the families of the 9/11 victims, some of the people who were injured on 9/11, and first responders who have had significant health issues based on exposure have filed lawsuits against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The Kingdom filed a motion to dismiss, claiming that they're entitled to sovereign immunity, and the judge heard argument on that motion, and right now we are waiting for the judge's decision about whether we will move forward with discovery against Saudi Arabia or whether we're heading to the Second Circuit.
Justin Green, this is a time for full disclosure. I was living across the street from the World Trade Center on 9/11. In fact, I was supposed to be up on top having breakfast that morning, and luckily a friend of mine canceled our meeting. But I was laying in bed and actually saw the underbelly of the plane fly over my apartment building. And I was there with my wife, and I had a 16-pound cat and a talking parrot, Charlie. So we didn't get out the first day. Everybody in my building was evacuated except me and my wife and a blind jazz musician. Finally, the next day, they came and they told us we had to leave. But in any case, I breathed in those toxins for over 24 hours and came down with cancer. And I wanted to ask you, what sort of injuries are people claiming now from the result of the breathing in of the toxins?
I mean, it runs a gambit. Cancer has been a major issue, and there's, as you probably know, there's a federal fund that was developed to help first responders, and ultimately, it really is the latency period is that kind of the, what's maybe in a way scheduled the effects. The people that initially developed respiratory issues became obvious sooner. The people that developed cancer that can be tied to their exposure to the environment down there after the attacks, depending on what type of cancer, became evident in, you know, years later. And there's still people now who are coming down with cancers that decent percentage, a much higher percentage than you would normally have that were exposed to 9/11. So there's a whole list of different illnesses that have been attributed to the exposure to the toxins that were down at Ground Zero.
Justin, what evidence is there to support the proposition that it was Saudi Arabia and not Iraq that was behind 9/11?
I mean, I think you'd have to start with some common sense. There was 15 of the 19 terrorists on the aircraft were from Saudi Arabia. The terrorist group Al-Qaeda was headed by Osama bin Laden, who has Yemeni background but actually was a Saudi Arabian citizen. Their belief system is rooted in the Wahhabi kind of sect of Islam, which is what Saudi Arabia has promoted and spent a fortune as part of their official government policy in promoting. The primary funding for Al-Qaeda came from Saudi Arabian sources, and that's not just what the plaintiffs are saying. That's actually in the 9/11 Commission report. The charities, and this is again alluded to the 9/11 Commission report, the charities that were founded by Saudi Arabia, funded by Saudi Arabia, oversaw by the government of Saudi Arabia, were a prime funding source for Al-Qaeda. And our allegations against Saudi Arabia also include identifying specific agents of Saudi Arabia who communicated directly with some of the terrorists, and what we allege is that they provided assistance to the terrorists.
What efforts has the Saudi Arabian government undertaken to deny any responsibility?
They've been pretty clear from the beginning that they deny it. If you look at, however, if you look at their actions against Saudi Arabia, it really wasn't until 2003 that they became a true ally America trying to fight al-Qaeda, and that's only after al-Qaeda conducted some terrorism acts in Saudi Arabia. But one of the things that they have is an amazing lobbying effort. They've hired over a dozen public relations and lobbying firms to try to promote this idea that they were not involved. And I think, in part of their lobbying effort is why President Obama vetoed JASTA.
Can you speak briefly about the role that the United States has played in supporting Saudi Arabian efforts, specifically under the Bush and Obama administrations?
In the lawsuit, the family members never sued Saudi Arabia until recently. Only after JASTA was passed did the families bring the lawsuit against Saudi Arabia. Before JASTA was passed, Saudi Arabia, in our opinion, was immune under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. However, a group of insurance companies did bring a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, and one class action was filed by a law firm against Saudi Arabia in 2003. And that was under the pre-JASTA law. So under pre-JASTA law, there was an exception for terrorism, but that exception for terrorism required our government to designate the state sponsor of terrorism as a state sponsor, and the United States had never designated Saudi Arabia as a state sponsor. It had designated countries like Syria and North Korea and Cuba. Iraq had been designated at one point, Sudan, but never Saudi Arabia. So the other exception that potentially could apply is the tort exception. And that's where if somebody working, a diplomat, for example, in New York has a car accident, the tort exception would be a exception to the diplomat being able to claim sovereign immunity so that he or she wouldn't have to pay for their negligence in causing the car accident. So that was the tort exception was actually what they were alleging, the tort exception to government immunity. But the tort exception requires that the entire tort, everything related to the claim occur in the United States. Not to get too deep into it, there's also a question about whether the tort exception could even be available in cases where the terrorism exception was not. So essentially what the court initially said was the terrorism exception is the only one that you can use for terrorism. You can't sue for terrorism under the tort exception to kind of get around the whole state sponsor designation requirement. And so to get to your question, the government has issued several letters to the court, stating their position. And essentially, their position has been that the plaintiff's claims should be dismissed, that the entire tort, the 9/11 tort, did not occur entirely in the United States. And ultimately, the court dismissed the claims first on this idea that you couldn't use the tort exception at all in cases where the terrorism exception did not apply, and the second time, based on the idea that the entire tort did not occur in the United States. Most of the funding for al-Qaeda was outside the United States. The training was outside the United States. And only the final kind of terrorism act occurred in the United States.
Yeah. Before we get to the question of how specifically the elements of the Saudi Arabian government enabled the attack, isn't it true that the commission that the United States set up to investigate the attack absolved Saudi Arabia from any responsibility? Isn't that what the Saudi Arabians are using to dodge any liability here?
That's what they're using. However, that's really not what the 9/11 Commission report found. What the 9/11 Commission report found, and they phrased it very carefully, is that they found no evidence that Saudi Arabia as an institution or senior Saudi Arabian officials supported al-Qaeda. They also said, however, that this doesn't mean that Saudi Arabian charities with substantial Saudi Arabian government involvement hadn't diverted funds to al-Qaeda. And they also, there's also a number of things in the commission report that seem to indicate that Saudi Arabia certainly, I would just say that certainly that more investigation would need. And I should also point out that several members of the commission are supporting the efforts of the families, essentially pushing back on this idea that Saudi Arabia was somehow absolved of responsibility in the 9/11 commission report.
Justin, what discoveries were unearthed in San Diego that were incorporated into this lawsuit?
So in San Diego, I mean, the one thing I'd say is we have not had any discovery. Saudi Arabia has never been required to produce witnesses under oath. In fact, the people that I'm going to talk about now who were involved in San Diego basically left the country after 9/11. The 9/11 Commission investigators were only permitted to interview them in Saudi Arabia in the presence of Saudi Arabian intelligence officials. So, there really hasn't been what I would call significant discovery or even investigation because these people were not cross-examined and were not under any kind of threat of criminal prosecution for lying or anything like that because of the circumstances. But in San Diego, prior to 9/11, there was a Saudi official named Thumairi, who was an imam working for the Saudi Ministry of Islamic Affairs in Saudi Arabia, promoting the Wahhabi kind of version of Islam, is a central government goal, and they have an entire ministry devoted to it. And they have employees all over the world. Each consulate and embassy has a ministry of Islamic Affairs office, and Thumairi was posted at the consulate, the Saudi Arabian consulate in Los Angeles. So he, the allegations are that he met with these two terrorists, a guy named Hazmi and a guy named Midhar, who were the first two 9/11 terrorists to come into the United States. He arranged for them to get housing. He appointed a gentleman by the name of Bayoumi, who also was a government employee. And Bayoumi has an interesting background. So Bayoumi supposedly working for a private Saudi aviation company. However, the company says no, he's got a no-show job, and his salary is actually paid by the Saudi government, where he's supposed to work at the aviation ministry. So you have this gentleman who's in town being paid by a company who's being reimbursed for his pay by the government, where he doesn't have to show up to work, and he clearly does not work at the company. It was called Dawa Avco. Does not work at the company, even though he's being paid to. But what he's doing is he's helping these two al-Qaeda 9/11 terrorists, Hazmi and Midhar. And there's a lot more detail, but the bottom line is Hazmi and Midhar are people that really don't speak English, don't have a background in the West, and without the assistance of Thumairi, without the assistance of Bayoumi, our allegations are that they would have been found out, that they needed that help, and it was essentially a cell in San Diego of government employees who were working with the 9/11 terrorists.
Justin, what is the best-case scenario in terms of the timetable for the lawsuit?
I think the best-case scenario is the judge issues a a ruling that permits us to start discovery tomorrow. There's already an order in the case that permits us to start begin taking depositions in April, and we're in April, and you know, for the next, you know, I don't know, several months, doing depositions of Saudi Arabian officials, asking the questions under oath that really have never been able to be asked of Saudi Arabia.
Justin, I just wanted to say, and as an aside, that as a personal injury law firm, you folks work on a contingency basis, so that you haven't made any money. You've just spent money on this over the course of many years. And I just want to commend you and your firm for taking on this enormously difficult task and this enormously risky proposition. How can people get more information on the class action lawsuit?
Most of the lawsuits, there is a class action lawsuit, but most of the lawsuits are filed individually. All the cases that we have are filed individually, and we're prosecuting them individually. They can go to our website. It's Kreindler, K-R-E-I-N-D-L-E-R.com, and they can. We actually have some information up on that website. The things that you have to understand, if you suffered after 9/11. Because of exposure to Ground Zero, there is a fund that you should get to a lawyer and make sure, you know, talk to the lawyer, see if you're eligible and get your application in, because if you don't, you could be timed out of that. If you want to join the lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, you can do that as well. And basically those are the two paths right now that are going forward.
The Michael Barish firm, I believe, that is helping people with the Victims Compensation Board.
Right. We're teamed up with Michael's firm. My partner, Noah Kishlevsky, and Michael are basically a team on that effort.
Well, we've come to the end of our time. Justin, Heidi and I want to thank you so much for the efforts that you and your firm have put in on this lawsuit. And we want to ask you to come back on once you win this motion and the case goes forward in discovery. It's going to be a real interesting discussion that we're going to have with you. So good luck.
Thank you very much. And I really thank you for your kind words and the opportunity to join your show.
Thanks, Justin.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Heidi, today, March 12th, marks the one-year anniversary of our friend Lynn Stewart's passing, and I thought we should remember that. I just finished a book called Law and Disorder, Lawyers You'll Like and Other Wonderful People. Lynn Stewart was in both those categories, and the introduction to the interview that we published in the book is something that I wrote, and I thought we could read that and then play what Chris Hedges had to say about Lynn Stewart. Of course, he spoke at her memorial.
Lynn Stewart was a teacher and a librarian before becoming a lawyer. She lived and raised her family on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where she practiced law in the community, representing everybody from tenants about to be evicted to accused criminal defendants. She, along with Ramsey Clark and Abdin Jabara, took on the defense of New Jersey blind cleric Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who was falsely accused, convicted of conspiring to blow up New York City landmarks, and sent to federal prison in Minnesota in 1995, where he died. In an effort to keep his name in front of the public, she visited her client in prison and issued a press release concerning a ceasefire in Egypt between the government there and the opposition Islamic group that Rahman supported. Her actions violated a prison regulation, and she was told to stop. 2 years later, after the terrorist attacks on 9/11, when George W. Bush had taken the presidency, his Attorney General John Ashcroft decided to make an example out of Lynn Stewart and had her indicted for conspiracy to materially aid terrorism. Ashcroft flew to New York City in 2002 and announced the indictment on a popular late-night television show hosted by David Letterman, thus prejudicing the chance of a fair trial. The government's twisted theory violated the First Amendment, positing that a press release supported terrorism. The Bush administration selected and prosecuted Lynn Stewart to make an example out of her and to scare and intimidate lawyers who would stand up for clients accused of terrorism-related charges. Stewart was tried in a courthouse not far from where the Twin Towers once stood by an anonymous, sequestered jury brought to court each day in a police van surrounded by guards. An atmosphere of fear was all-pervasive. Huge photographs of Osama bin Laden were flashed on the wall of the courtroom. Not a single witness testified that Lynn Stewart had any connection to any terrorist activity anywhere. Although she was ably defended by a team of stellar movement lawyers, including Michael Tigar, Ellen Yaroshevsky, Jill Shallow Levine, and Liz Fink, she was convicted of aiding terrorism because of the press release. One juror, a black woman, complained afterwards that she felt that the jurors would get her if she did not vote for the conviction. The show trial had taken place in the same courtroom where Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were framed up and sentenced to death on the false charge of giving the secret of the atomic bomb to Russia.
Lynn was sentenced in 2006 by Judge John Kotel to 28 months in prison. She was disbarred as a felon. She had recently been treated for breast cancer, which was to recur when she was incarcerated. The government appealed the sentence, taking the position that it was far too short. The appellate court agreed and sent the case back to Judge Kotel for resentencing, demanding that he give her, a 70-year-old grandmother, 30 years. When she was asked by Amy Goodman on the news show Democracy Now! Whether she would do it again, Lynn answered, yes. The appellate court wrote that she showed no remorse. President George W. Bush's cousin, Judge John Walker, sat on the appellate court and was particularly enraged against Stewart. After a hearing attended by hundreds of Stewart supporters, Judge Kotel sentenced her to 10 years, a virtual death sentence. The audience of supporters in the court let out a collective gasp. Her granddaughter shrieked. Attorney Levine rose to question the judge as to why he did it. He answered that he was ordered to. Stewart received wide support, mostly from the left. Her husband, the black activist Ralph Pointer, was a steady presence by her side. Mainstream attorneys shunned the case. Lynn Stewart was sent to a prison hospital in Texas. She served 4 years. The cancer came back, likely the result of stress. For 9 long months, Ralph Pointer led a relentless international campaign to win compassionate release. An online petition received 85,000 signatures and the support of prominent voices like Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Noam Chomsky, and Dick Gregory. Finally, Lynn's application was approved by the Bureau of Prisons and quickly signed by Judge Kotel on New Year's Eve of 2013. The next day, the then 74-year-old grandmother arrived at LaGuardia Airport. In a letter to Judge Kotel, Lynn wrote, "I do not intend to go gentle into that good night," as Dylan Thomas wrote. "There is much to be done in the world. I do know that I do not want to die in prison, a strange and loveless place. I want to be where all is familiar, in a word, home." She lived another 3 years and 3 months, actively organizing and speaking. She was a woman of extraordinary ability, courage, virtue, grace, and kindness. We go now to hear Chris Hedges, who was the last speaker at Lynn Stewart's memorial meeting in New York City.
Those who spend a lifetime resisting are long-distance revolutionaries, are often couples. I discovered this in wartime. For to resist day after day, month after month, year after year, in a nation convulsed by the poisons of nationalism, racism, and militarism is lonely, tiring, and dangerous. It is to be rejected and demonized by the dominant culture. A celebration of the life of Lynn Stewart is a celebration of the life of Ralph Pointer and a celebration of their family. Lynn would never have been Lynn without Ralph, and Ralph would never have been Ralph without Lynn. And the love that sustained them was the love they turned with such ferocity outwards on a loveless world of injustice, racism, poverty, capitalist exploitation, and state violence. And there are no shortage of agents of this loveless world who were knocked off balance when hit by the blast furnace of Lynn Stewart and Ralph Pointer. There is nothing moral about condemning a crime of history, although there are no shortage of individuals and institutions that have claimed the mantle of morality by rooting themselves in an atrocity of the past to ignore the atrocities of the present. The moral life is attained by condemning and fighting the crimes of the present, which, as we know from the mutations of white supremacy, is usually the newest iteration of the crime of history dressed up in new clothing. Lynn was for this reason an exemplar of what it means to live the moral life. What drives this life? Knowledge, certainly, an understanding of systems of oppression and how they work, courage, tenacity, anger. For how can you walk out of the American inner cities and the American gulags and not be angry? But I would say the heart of this life is a deep and profound capacity for empathy. The sadness and distress that comes when you see people suffer. Lynn spoke about her own epiphany as a nice, white, middle-class girl from Queens who went to work as a librarian in 1962 in Harlem, which, although Queens was 5 miles away, she said she did not know existed. And in the Harlem school system, her epiphany was triggered by the cruelty to children. And there was someone else in that school incensed by this cruelty, the teacher and union organizer across the hall from the school library, Ralph Pointer, whose alacrity at making common cause with Lynn was probably aided, as Lynn said, by the fact that at that time her skirt was as short as her hair was long. Lynn wrote a letter to the parents of the school that said, "You're constantly told that your children can't learn. Your children doesn't learn. But what you don't know is every other child's mother is being told the same thing. And actually, all these children can learn, but you're caught up in the system." And Ralph distributed the letter in front of the school and called for a meeting. And Ralph, not for the first time, was fired. And that triggered their fight for community schools. There may have been 6 kids to support, and Lynn may at the time have been the only wage earner. But when she said to Ralph she wanted to go to law school, Ralph said, "Well, I guess you better go then." And she went to, as she said, fight government on behalf of someone who didn't really have the tools or wherewithal to do that, and to be able to go home and look at myself in the mirror. The movements in the 1960s briefly created a better legal system, not a fair one, but not one so overtly prejudiced against the poor. A right to an attorney, the dismissal of evidence and an illegal search. But the elites steadily chipped away at these gains until they were once again wiped out, until once again a cop's word became law, even when it was obviously a lie. Lynn kept fighting, not winning so much anymore, but fighting. She defended the poor. She defended radicals. She defended all those the state were trying to crush and erase. And then she took the case of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who, and I speak now as the former Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times, had nothing to do with the 1993 attacks on the World Trade Center. But who was demonized as the face of terror by the government and the press. And in the end, the state not only lynched the sheikh whose sentencing saw Lynn weep in court, but lynched Lynn too. Not so much for defending the sheikh, but for spending years defending people like Larry Davis, a young black man who acted in his own self-defense against armed police. And she too was prosecuted in a show trial. A trial where she was open and vocal about her friendship with Mumia Abu-Jamal, because decent people do not deny their friends. And was disbarred and sent to prison. And then Lynn's family organized to shame the state to release her. To resist radical evil is to endure a life that, by the standards of the wider society, is a failure. It is to defy injustice at the cost of your career, your reputation, your financial solvency, and at times your life. It is to be a lifelong heretic. And perhaps this is the most important point. It is to accept that the dominant culture, even the liberal elites, will push you to the margins and attempt to discredit not only what you do, but also your character. For when you stand, as Lynn Stewart did, with the oppressed, you are treated like the oppressed. The great radical priest Daniel Berrigan told me that the essence of faith is the belief that the good draws to it the good. The Buddhists call this karma, but he said he did not know where it went. He trusted that it went somewhere. And we are called to do the good, or at least the good so far as we can determine it, and then let it go. I saw in the conflicts I covered as a war correspondent the power of this faith, which lies outside any religious or philosophical creed. This faith is what Václav Havel called in his essay, The Power of the Powerless, Living in Truth. A life spent living in truth exposes the corruption, lies, and deceit of the state. It is a refusal to be part of the charade. And I saw how when the great resistors are taken from us, their nobility and courage shine on in the darkness, calling all of us to save ourselves, to save each other, and to save our souls. There will come a moment in your life when you will face your own fear. You will be forced to choose between standing with the oppressed or remaining silent. And you will think of Lynn, and she will be there. Her presence, her spirit, and you will do what is right because you cannot betray her. Because the cruelty around you demands that you respond no matter what the cost. And in the Christian faith, we call this resurrection. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
But time, instead of it all. But we cannot function, we can feel nothing at all. They hurt us at home, they beat us at school. Hate us when we're clever, despise us when we're fools. Then they got us so fucking crazy, we cannot follow their rules. Working class hero is something. They scared us 20 odd years. And then they expect you to pick a career. But we cannot function, we are so full of fear. And TV, and they make you feel clever and classless and free. Got us all still being peasants, as far as I can see. Hero is something to be.